are listening to a free version of Majority Report with Sam Steeder. To support this show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
It is Tuesday, August 21st, 2018. My name is Sam Steeder. This is the five-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On the program today, Matthew Horace on The Black and the Blue, the crimes, racism, and injustice in America's law enforcement. Also on the program today, EPA's new coal pollution will lead to more deaths, says the EPA. Also on the program today, DOJ reveals docs that show bankers joked about the oncoming mortgage crisis in 08. Brett Kavanaugh's bat-crap crazy 1998 Bill Clinton memo revealed. Meanwhile, nationwide prison labor strikes start today, could be the largest ever in this country. Meanwhile, U.S. Completely abandoning Iraqis who helped the U.S. And a follow-up, today the 15th, or yesterday I should say, the 15th Michigan official charged as the Michigan health director charged with manslaughter in Flint. Confederate statue toppled by a UNC protest, and the U.S. deports a Nazi guard to Germany. All that and more on today's program, ladies and gentlemen. excuse me for one second. We should turn down that fan in there for one second. It is Tuesday, folks, and just a reminder, you can support this program by going to jointhemajorityreport.com. Jointhemajorityreport.com is the web address where you can support this program by becoming a member. And as a way of saying thank you, we give you extra content every single day. All right, I want to get to this. This is too funny. Hold on, we'll wait for Michael, who's just come back from the bathroom. So here is watching a lot of C-SPAN, Washington Journal these days, just to monitor to see if, to make sure that Ronald Reagan isn't, we're not having our prime callers going and spending too much time at Washington Journal. And we found this little gem. This is Washington Journal hosted by, who was it? I don't know. I don't know who the host was. Forgive me. I don't know any of the Washington.
And I don't think we're supposed to.
They want to make it about the people, yeah. And that's fair enough. And they hosted Sebastian Gorka.
Character actor.
Here we go.
And with our guest, go ahead.
Yes, I want to thank C-SPAN.
Oh, pause it for 1 second. I should tell you, they obviously take phone calls. This is a caller on the phone.
On with our guest. Go ahead.
Yes, I want to thank C-SPAN. And Mr. Gorka, I just really look forward to when you and Corey Lewandowski, David Bossy, Don Jr., Jared Kushner, all of you are exposed for the treasonous bitches that you are.
Apologies for that. We'll go to Peter.
See, but may I comment?
Please.
Why is that man on the Democrat line? Why is there such hatred out there? It's just un-American. This is a duly elected president. People need to get over the fact that we have a republic and an individual was chosen to be president. I worked for him. Yes, I was a politically commissioned officer. But this level of hatred...
Whoa, 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 whoa. First off, I like the fact that Gorka is doing the I'm going to be on C-SPAN, so I'm going to just tone it down a little bit. He was a what? Could you rewind that?
To be president. I worked for him. Yes, I was a politically commissioned officer. But this level of hatred, not good for the health of the Republic. I love C-SPAN, Pedro. This is one of the best shows out there. But that's un-American.
That's
Republican line.
I'm so sorry to say this. Did he just make up a title? A politically commissioned officer?
We are YouTube.
I had my own. Oh, here it is. Oh, we have a mock-up of his, this would be his business card. We mocked it up there for everyone to see. Former politically commissioned officer, the White House.
Do you hear the heat in his voice, Sanjay?
PCO Dr. Sebastian Gorka, PhD. There you go. At least he's just made up his own title. And if you Google it, just to check it out, because maybe somebody else uses it. You Google politically commissioned officer. We took the time to do that. We have the first result of seven. Listen, Sebastian Gorka tells Buck why he really left the White House. Here's number two. Sebastian Gorka, Dr. G on Twitter. Sorry. Sebastian Gorka. Oh, we went backwards. Okay, here we go.
You're blocked.
That's blocked. He said this, I guess, at an event with the Westminster Institute. And I was a politically commissioned officer of President Trump now. Now he's one specifically of President Trump, not of the U.S. government. Gorka, Trump called me saying he's sticking to his agenda. This is Ungrabian. I'm concerned. It was the greatest honor of my life to serve for the president as a politically commissioned officer. And then in The Hill in February, working for the most powerful man in the world as a politically commissioned officer is not only a unique honor. This is him, I guess.
Is he commissioned during private time or public time?
And then there's a PDF. Wait a second. What's the PDF? That's the only one. Michael Evans, The Making of African Army. Wow. All right.
The making of
Sebastian Gorka on foreign policy. I was a politically commissioned officer. He's the only person who has ever claimed to be a politically commissioned officer. Ever.
And I did a great job.
Did a great job.
By the way.
All right. Well, we got to take a break here in a minute. But there it is. Sebastian Gorka, politically commissioned.
That's
officer.
PCO Gorka to you.
That caller was pretty informed too, right? I mean, that's the thing about C-SPAN listeners. David Bossy.
Yeah, I was going to say, David Bossy's a reach. That's not just your standard issue like, you know, Flynn, Don Jr.
Folks, there are primaries today in Alaska and Wyoming. So get out and vote. I mean, it's Foster Freeze is running for Senate, right? Is he running for Senate in Wyoming? I don't know how many people we have who vote in the Republican primary, and I don't know that they have open primaries for Republicans there. But Foster Freeze would be really sort of disturbing to have a...
Oh, I think he's running for governor.
Oh, he's running for governor. Oh, well, God bless him.
Charlie Kirk's dad.
Is he?
His daddy.
No, daddy. He's a funder.
He's a sugar daddy.
Yeah.
He's also the guy who said you should use aspirin as birth control by just holding it between your knees.
And Andrea Mitchell literally looked at him like, I've done like pleasant interviews with war criminals across the earth. I have no idea what the hell you just said, dude.
All right, we got to take a quick break. We'll be right back with Matthew Horace. We'll be right back. We are back. Sam Cedar on the Majority Report on the phone. Matthew Horace, author with Ron Harris of The Black and the Blue, A Cop Reveals the Crimes, Racism, and Injustice in America's Law Enforcement. Matt, welcome to the program.
Good morning, and thanks for having me.
All right, let's just start with, like, you tell the story of Billy, being, I think it was in Philly, and having a run-in with a canine, I guess a cop, if you will. Tell us about that and how that ended up, how you ended up entering law enforcement yourself.
Sure. Well, you know, I was home from college. I was NCAA Division I athlete. I was home for one summer from school, and I decided to attend a celebration when the Philadelphia 76ers won a national title. And when I exited from the subway station, I saw a police officer with a dog moving in my direction. I didn't know if they were doing crowd control or whatever, but out of nowhere, I'm hit by the dog, and I'm left on the street to bleed. The officer yelled some obscenities at me and kept it moving. When I finally got help from a police officer to get to the hospital, they took a full report. And some months later, I was in the hospital for about a week, but some months later, my parents got a copy of the police report. And the report, number one, listed me as a suspect, not a victim. And number two, in the report, the police officers put that they didn't know the nature of my injuries or how I had sustained them. So that was my first interaction with the, you know, what happens behind the blue line.
Well, I'm curious. I mean, tell us about your reaction. I mean, what was your experience with police before then?
Well, up until that point, I never really had any one-on-one experience with police other than the officers who worked at my high school. And, you know, growing up in Philadelphia, I was familiar with all the stories about policing and Frank Rizzo and the past through my parents and family members and others. But I had never really had any particularly negative experiences with police up until that point. But I will say this, I was determined not to let that deter me. And it didn't get in the way of me having an interest in public safety because, you know, I felt like I should be a part of the solution, not a part of the problem.
Well, I mean, so what, it's just curious to me that growing up as a black youth in Philly, no sort of predisposition one way or another to the cops?
Well, no, because I grew up in a upper middle class community. My parents were working people, educated. We were always taught to respect authority. And to the extent that you could, I was taught to, you know, sort of understand my surroundings, keep myself out of problematic situations. And when police officers tell you to do something, you do it. I mean, I had those kind of parents that if they'd have gotten a call from the police department, right, they'd have come down there pretty darn angry and probably more with me than with them. So I stayed away from police. I stayed out of trouble. And I tried to lead, you know, an exemplary lifestyle.
Okay. And so, all right. So you joined the police, and just give us a sense of what your career consisted of, because you were in like seven different law enforcement agencies.
Well, no. I started as a local police officer in Arlington, Virginia, in the local policing. I left there and joined the ATF in 1988. And while within the ATF, I held like six or seven different assignments in different parts of the country. In doing that, I had the opportunity to work with and manage and lead police officers in different environments, from Baltimore to Montana to Washington State and Idaho and others. So I've been involved with policing for the better part of my adult life.
Let's talk about what you found when you joined. I mean, if you joined the police because you wanted to be part of the solution, what was the problem?
Well, I think, you know, it doesn't take you very long to learn in policing, and it didn't take me long to learn that people bring their prejudices, their implicit and unconscious biases to the job, and oftentimes those biases manifest themselves in the way that people treat people on the street. So even as a local police officer, there were any number of times when I had to address other officers in terms of how they spoke to other people when they were around me, or the language they used in speaking with people when they were around me or other officers. And even working within the ATF, I think I tell a story in the book about an agent who used the N-word when addressing African-Americans one evening. And then we had to, you know, sort of get into it over that. But this is something that black officers and minority officers know, that when you're around policing long enough, you will hear and see these sort of behaviors. So some of the things the world is seeing now on video and in the public come as no surprise to us.
Well, so I mean, how do your fellow officers react in those situations? I mean, is all it takes is you saying like, look, it's inappropriate for you to use that kind of language, and it goes away? I mean, what happens when you confront these guys?
Well, you know, it's very complex because we're taught from the very beginning, even when you're out of the police academy, the first thing you're taught, man, is like, hey, what happens in this car stays in this car. And there's sort of an unwritten code amongst us. And everybody knows that we don't tell on each other. So the organizations have their own individual HR rules and discipline policies, and they really dictate what happens to people when they violate those policies. And use of racial slurs falls in that category in most cases. So many officers are faced with the choice of whether to report it or whether to deal with it head on with the individual who's committing the infraction. And I've known officers to do both. I mean, in my case, I reported at least one incident and the individual was disciplined. In other cases, you know, officers choose to take it out to the backyard sort of approach and, you know, deal with somebody, you know, one-on-one. Hey, that was inappropriate. I'm hurt. I'm offended. You know, those sorts of things. But these things do happen. And for people to try to suggest that they don't is you know, it just shows lack of candor and lack of understanding.
Oh, no. Yeah. I mean, maybe I'm a little bit jaundiced, but I don't think I'd be surprised if I met someone who didn't, you know, assume something like this happened. I'm just curious, like for you as an officer and you're faced with this situation, right, where like, I mean, this is a fairly unique situation relative to your white colleagues, right? Because,
right, well,
I mean, because they're not, there's just like one other great set of dynamic between you and your colleagues that they don't have to deal with, but you have to deal with, right? Where you're in this position of, do I report them or do I deal? I mean, so I'm curious, like, you know, what you go through in that situation.
Well, these situations are very hurtful. You know, most of us who worn the badge, we understand that we're in this situation where you're never quite blue enough and you're never quite black enough. When these things come up, they are extremely hurtful. They're angering. And what happens is, one second, you're with someone that you believe has your back and will do anything they can to save your life. And in the next second, you hear that same person using a racial slur against someone who looks like you. And then the next words you hear are, but I didn't mean you, or that doesn't apply to you. Or, you know, in my case, the individual just said, oops, you know. So these things are hurtful. And I think through the years, organizations have done the best they can to try to make people understand where their prejudices and biases are and how they're supposed to conduct themselves in the workplace. But the bottom line is this: as long as we're having this discussion about disparate treatment, you know, out on the streets and with citizens and police, we can't move away from the fact that people, including police officers, do have implicit and unconscious biases that impact the way they treat people.
And so, I mean, and in the book, you walk through a lot of the shootings that we've talked about on this program over the past 4 or 5 years, I guess. And I mean, from your perspective, and I want to walk through both the perception, but also in terms of like the reality on the ground, what has and what has not changed. In other words, like, are there more shootings now, or is it just simply that there is more attention being paid or was, I guess?
So there's a couple answers. First, there's more attention being paid because of the promulgation of video technology and cell phone technology. So now more people are seeing more of the action more of the time, when in the past, a very small number of people were exposed to the actual truth of the matter. So now things are on video, just like what happened in Baltimore last week. Things are on video, it goes viral, and instantly hundreds of millions of people see what a very small percentage of people used to see. Secondly, what hasn't changed is, if you look at what happened in Baltimore, you look at what happened in Chicago with Laquan McDonald. In that case, one officer fired 16 times, killing Laquan McDonald, and four officers told the same story about what they saw and what they believed, and ultimately all officers were indicted, charged, and are now serving prison time. So we still have this issue of don't tell, don't rat out your partners, because we got to stand tall, we got to close ranks, and we can't afford for one of us to get in trouble. And hey, if one of us gets in trouble, all of us gets in trouble. I don't know too many careers as a culture where people will band together and go to jail for each other over a wrong anything.
Well, I mean, is that true, though? I mean, if one of you gets in trouble, do all of you get in trouble? Or is that just a way of intimidating?
Well, I don't think it's true, but I think a part of our culture has been to stand tall and stand together. And, you know, it sort of embodies itself in what happened in Chicago with Laquan McDonald. All the officers that were on the scene saw the same thing. One officer shot, four officers didn't, but all the officers told the same story as the shooter. And ultimately, they were all convicted and sent to prison. So we got to get past this culture of, you know, we have to stand together and band together no matter what, because it's us against them. Because if it's us against them, we know who us is, but who are them?
Yeah, I mean, I want to get to sort of your thoughts on how that on how that happens, but you know, I'm curious too. As you went around, and you spoke to different, you know, I guess facets of law enforcement, the law enforcement professionals, but also members of the community, folks who have been the subjects of police violence and I guess, you know, elected officials and whatnot. I mean, what, from your perspective, where are the big differences in attitudes and perspectives on what you do? I mean, as you sort of like, where are those perspectives that might be most surprising?
I think one of the things is that I don't think the public understands how, like, when police departments recruit, and they bring in officers and they hire officers and they go through this rigorous process. Many times the officers have had no access or exposure to communities of color or communities who don't look like them. So that's a hurdle that you have to overcome. But you can overcome that by understanding, you know, what your own internal biases are, your own experiences. Communities assume that people are prepared to deal with them. And then from the other side of the perspective, communities don't understand that, you know, in all my years of work, and I never worked with anyone, and I've worked with some racist people, but I've never worked with anyone who came to work with the idea, I'm going to go out there and I'm going to kill someone today. And, you know, I've never been around anyone that I felt that was the case with. The other thing communities keep asking us repeatedly, and I got to ask this question throughout the process, why can't officers shoot people in the leg? Why can't they shoot to injure? You know, and the standard answer for us is always the same. We shoot to diminish the threat. And the way we do that is by shooting center mass. And that's the way we train. And that's the way we perform under stress. So as I told people in the past, if we shoot you in the leg, it's probably going to be a mistake, because that's not what we're trained to do at the end of the day. So there needs to be some understanding on the community's part. There needs to be more understanding and compassion on law enforcement's part.
I mean, is that type of training, does that make sense?
Oh, it absolutely makes sense. I mean, to someone who's been out there and involved, you kind of know when you're under fire and there's a threat, you need to stop that threat as soon as you can. And the only way you do that is to hit your target in, you know, vital body areas and the largest area of the body.
But what if you're not under fire? I mean, right? I mean, that's the issue, right? That's more of the issue, right? Like, I mean, we're not talking. You're not going through stories of a police officer under fire. You're going through stories of a police officer who thinks that they may be under fire in the future.
Well, not only that, but you get back to what we talk about in the book, is that boogeyman syndrome, thinking that everyone is against you. Look at what happened in the Betty Crutcher shooting. You have five officers on the scene with Betty Shelby shooting. You have five officers on the scene in Oklahoma. One officer fires, the others don't. One officer felt in fear of her life. The other officers didn't. And, you know, she was removed and she was disciplined, but then she was brought back. So this idea that when I'm in fear of my life, I can use and I'm justified in using force. That's what we are trained and that's what we use. And that's what we say when things happen.
Well, I know. I mean, and I'm not, I mean, like, is that a problem with the training? I mean, you're trained to shoot for the largest body mass when you're under fire, but the definition of under fire, you're trained to perceive it as certainly, or you're allowed to experience it as a very, like, loose experience. I mean,
right. What you're describing, obviously, many of those cases, the officers aren't under fire. You know, in the Walter Scott case, the officer couldn't have been under fire. In the Betty Shelby case, she couldn't have been under fire. In some of the other cases in East Pittsburgh and the one in Baltimore, they weren't under fire. So it's clearly examples of excessive force. We aren't taught how to use We aren't taught to shoot people in the back. We're taught not to shoot people in the back. So some of these things that you see happen not only are a violation of policy, they're against the law.
But I mean, is that a function? Are those things happening because there isn't proper training?
Well, I think it's a combination of improper refresher training, but it's also a problem with the individual officers and the way they're conducting their jobs.
And so how do we address that? I mean, if the training is not necessarily problematic and there's just a couple of the way you're talking about it, it's almost like there's a certain inevitability.
Right. Well, I think it has to be addressed. There has to be processes in place. And there are, in many cases, disciplinary processes and like. But what happens is in our culture, this is a cultural issue. And I'm going to say something to you to help you put this perspective. Sometimes culture eats strategy for lunch. So we try to implement these strategies and policies. And let me give you, for instance, in the Starbucks case in Philadelphia, the first thing the police chief did without having all the information, was he came out and he backed the troops. Well, good leaders back their troops. We know that. But good leaders also get all the good information before they go out on national television and give an answer. In this case, he had to come back and retract that statement when he had more information. And then he retracted it and he said, hey, these officers weren't acting within the scope of what we're supposed to do. However, Starbucks was the reason because they called us there. So it's it becomes at a certain level a policy issue, but then at other levels it becomes conduct, accountability, and behavior.
In the book, you talk, I think it was to a retired New York police officer who basically said, like, what we did back in the day, maybe it was even the 80s, I think, we would get thrown in jail for today, right?
Right.
I mean, what changes? I mean, so in other words, like that cop, I mean, presumably, right? Cops are not doing those same things. They're doing some things, but they're not doing what that cop was doing in the 80s. What is
right.
the difference? It's not just internally everybody got along, together in the station house and said, look, guys, this stuff, we got to leave it in the 80s. It's the 90s now, or it's the aughts. We can't do that anymore, right? Like, was there outside change that changed that behavior/culture?
Well, I think there was outside and internal. I think there were external forces like citizen review boards and things like that in different departments that brought in advanced oversight and, other eyes on incidents. There was a change and shift in culture in organizations that sort of to make a shift and say, hey, certain things were unacceptable. But we thought it was very important in this book to make sure we got the appropriate voices to tell the truth. Because what happens is there's a certain segment of society that doesn't believe that these sort of things happen. And then all of us that work within the field understand. And let me give you an example. In this case, the officer says very clearly, and keep in mind, most police officers don't develop their own crime fighting strategies. The strategies are developed by police leaders, by politicians, by mayors, by citizen review boards and the like. So in this case, what this story illustrates in the book is that he was told by a superior who was told by a member of a city council that they were going to do a walkthrough at a certain time of the day. Therefore, they were told to make sure that corner was clear of everyone, any crimes, any drug dealing, etc. Because they were told to make sure that corner was clear, the tacit green light was given that by all means, make sure no one is on that corner. So the question comes, the first question is, why aren't we doing that? And why aren't we doing something effective every day, not just for the city council? And secondly, is it okay to empty the corner at all costs? In this case, apparently it was. So the officer was very candid with us in telling us how they proceeded to do that. And that's an example of bad policing. Most people would agree with you that I know that would be unacceptable in today's environment and for good reason.
Well, what's your perspective on Black Lives Matter? I mean, insofar as the awareness that it is created in terms of the way black people are policed.
Right. Well, I think that they have and had their place and continue to have their place in raising the awareness. I mean, they essentially did what civil rights leaders did in the 1960s. And they raised the awareness by using cell phones and technology and social media to ensure that the entire world knew what was happening here in the United States in different places. They exploited the idea of what I call coptics, the optics of policing in the digital age. They exploited this idea that what happens in Miami can now happen in New York in a nanosecond via viral videos and social media. So they did that. I think where things went awry was when police decided that, you know, we were under attack. Well, we're under attack because everybody's videoing what they're seeing, and it's not all of us, it's some of us, thus creating this whole movement with Blue Lives Matter and, you know, those sorts of things. Now, in the book, we talk a lot about, if you really read and if you really absorb and you really pay attention to history and data, right, everything that we see and experience in society will tell you that Black lives don't matter. So I think to have the discussion about Black Lives Matter and Blue Lives Matter and White Lives Matter, listen, at the end of the day, all lives should matter, but all lives haven't mattered. And that was part of the reason why we decided to write the book and explore this issue.
What is your sense about how, I mean, I don't know if you're familiar, Chris Hayes wrote a book about the colony and a nation. And his thesis was that we have two large modes of policing in this country. One is the sort of the protect and serve, and that one is reserved, you know, not exclusively for white people, but certainly for white people and people living, not living in poverty, let's say. Whereas people living in poverty and largely we talk about minority folk living primarily in urban centers, there's a different form of policing, which is more about control. Give me your sense of your perspective on something like that.
Well, I mean, I think it's clear that, you know, the social issues are very different in different socioeconomic environments. That's very clear. But also knowing and having done policing, I understand from the ground level that the expectation is different in different communities. And people have a very real right to be upset that when you ask white people in America, what do you think about your police and what's your opinion? And people say, our police are great. They protect and serve. They come when we call them. They're courteous. They're polite to our children. They speak to them in playgrounds. And then when you talk to people in some urban areas, you say, what's your experience? And you say, we don't understand why police call us names or swear at us or yell at us. You know, even good people, right? So there is a difference in perspective on how policing is being done in different areas. And, you know, in the book, we talk to a Chicago commander. And she says, you know, when she used to go out as a supervisor, the citizens will come up to her and say, we don't understand why your officers call us this or call us that. So I think in working all these years in the profession, we know and I know, and if people are candid, they will tell you that certain behaviors are not tolerated in certain communities. So then it goes back to, as a community, sort of demanding and asking for the way you want to be policed. So we talk about that in the book as well.
One of the things that I've heard is that part of the reason why the police continue there's behavior that is, you know, poor policing, but then it's, you know, like you say, it's in many respects there's a culture where you will protect your fellow police officers even in those instances. To what extent do like local DAs have a role in impacting the culture in a given police force?
Sure. Well, I think that they go from 1 second working with people, just like I have, day in and day out, long hours, interviews, investigating crime, investigating victims of crime and perpetrators of crime. So one day and 7 days they're doing that. And then you turn around and they're forced to have to investigate someone who they worked with or someone who knows who they worked with. So it's a very difficult thing to do. But at the end of the day, what most people that I know will tell you is that once the penalties for protecting people who do wrong become greater than the allegiances to the people who do wrong, that once they become greater, then you'll start to see things change. And even from the DA perspective, when they have to arrest a cop, because of something they've done, whether it's use of force or lying on a report or something like that. It sends a rippling message throughout the organization. And it's generally not a good message, but it sends a message nonetheless that perhaps if you're considering these behaviors, this might happen to you as well. So I think the DAs and the attorneys and the U.S. attorneys, they play a role, and they should play. And where appropriate, they should play a very strong role.
Do we need more independent community review boards because of that dilemma that you have? You know, DAs have the ability, prosecutors have the ability to provide accountability, but there's a lot of disincentive to do so. I mean, similar to you with your colleagues or a cop with their colleagues. I mean, do we need more of those community review boards?
Well, I think community review boards are great if the right people with the right credentials are on them. But also, in some cases where things are extremely sensitive, you need sort of like an independent prosecutor, just like you would for any major federal investigation where there's a conflict of interest. If there's a conflict of interest, you bring in another person to handle it that doesn't possess the same conflict. And it's really a simple solution, but it has to be one that people are willing to embark upon.
What's your sense of, you know, towards the last couple of years of the Obama administration, the DOJ Civil Rights Division began to get more and more aggressive in looking at police departments, seeing systemic problems, and making these police departments aware that, you know, we could come in here and provide some accountability. And then I think it was, 4 days after Donald Trump was inaugurated that Jeff Sessions said, yeah, that's over. I'm curious as to what you think the implications of that are, if there are any.
Well, sure. I mean, no police department wants to be under a consent decree. But one thing is for certain. Once the Department of Justice, with its immense resources, comes in and starts looking at every single report, every single case, every single officer, every single incident, what they find is going to be the result in a report, and it's going to result in consequences. So no one wants to go through that. At the end of the last administration, there were a number of police departments that were under consent decrees, and the changes that were occurring were monumental and transformative. So to come in and just reverse all those changes, it sends a message specifically to communities of color that the government doesn't care. And again, we're back to that Black Lives Don't Matter issue again, because why, if you look at things from a leadership lens, if you have a problem, why not solve the problem?
Right. And it sends a message to the police departments, too. Right. I mean, that
absolutely.
We have no accountability.
Don't worry. Keep doing business as usual. Don't worry. Keep doing business as usual. Manage yourselves. And, you know, if that were working, we wouldn't need the Department of Justice. But the Department of Justice is there for a reason, no matter which administration they're working under. And I've worked under, you know, 4 or 5 administrations. So.
Matt Harris, the book is The Black and the Blue, A Cop Reveals the Crimes, Racism, and Injustice in America's Law Enforcement. We'll put a link to it at majority.fm. Thanks so much for your time today. I really appreciate it.
Thank you. Have a wonderful day.
You too. Bye-bye. Boop, boop. All right, folks. We're going to take a quick break, head into the fun half, wherein we will have fun talking about some of the horrible things in our society. That's the way we do it around here.
It's not all bad.
No, it's not all bad. It's not all bad. There's some good stuff.
Teens aren't reading books. That's not all bad.
I wasn't going to talk about that. Yes. I just wanted that story to send to my daughter. I don't know why. Because I'm turning into my dad, I guess. Who would send me clippings of Ann Landers and say, don't become a statistic.
Are you serious?
Yeah.
Wow. All right. Yep. Well, that's an empathy boost for you.
Folks, you can support this program by going to jointhemajorityreport.com. Jointhemajorityreport.com. When you do, for less than 50 cents a day, you can become a member of this program and help this program thrive, grow, continue. Do a great job. Also, JustCoffee.coop, fair trade coffee, tea, or chocolate. Use the coupon code MAJORITY, get 10% off. And as you know, today is Tuesday. You know this because I said this earlier in the program. Some people might get confused.
A lot of people tune in to know what day it is.
Some people get confused about days. I personally know people who think like it, that Sunday sometimes is like a Thursday.
That's extreme.
That's crazy, right?
That is.
I mean, those
crazy.
Are. You couldn't get any further away from that day.
Just,
but today is Tuesday, Michael, and
yes, indeed.
As such, this is the day that the Michael Brooks Show happens in the evening. Really.
Correct.
And so you have this is your 1 year anniversary of doing this program. Is that correct?
It is, and I really would. I mean,
is it really though?
I mean, it is ish. It might have been last week. Might have been technically.
Okay,
it.
Whatever.
But we're going to say tonight.
I've
is.
Never gotten the anniversary right for the Majority Report, so
we're going to say tonight is.
Okay.
And I do. I want to thank you.
Oh well, thank
I want to thank Matt.
Oh.
I want to thank everybody in this audience that has, you know, a lot
what
of people.
About Brendan?
I've been thanked enough for
I
last
do,
week.
I do want to thank Brendan. Brendan okay. was great last week. And sure. I want to thank everybody in the audience who's come over. And, you know, it's been a really successful first year. And I have been teasing that there is going to be a special celebrity guest tonight to celebrate that first year.
Okay.
And I'm about to reveal who that
wow.
is.
Wow. This is, should we get, do we have some type of drum roll
that
for
would
this?
Be
this
you.
Seems like a big, I don't have a drum roll.
Matt, do you have a drum roll?
I gotta.
And I just want to say, I want to apologize in advance. This is almost sure to disappoint people.
Probably.
Including most especially Matt. Matt was texting me. He's like, did you get H. John Benjamin? He's coming in. You think maybe we could, I'll bring a reefer stick for us.
Benjamin does not get high.
Let me riff a little bit. No, I'm quite excited to announce that really my sensei, you, Sam Cedar is going to be in tonight. Finally making his first TMBS appearance.
There you go. There you go, folks. I've been waiting a year. I wanted to see if the show would continue before I get on. I don't want to.
Right.
I'll
sure
be here. I'll be here
ground.
Tonight. I will be coming directly from my softball game.
Very excited to have you.
Cutting softball short tonight.
I'm seriously, I'll thank you on the show, but thank you seriously for, you know, the support and everything. We'll talk about it more tonight. And also, we'll probably want some, I'm going to indulge.
Are there
going to
be any interesting guests on the program, or
sorry?
Is it just going to be me?
Sorry?
Any other interesting guests? Or just...
No, it's just going to be you.
I'm back this week.
Matt's back.
Matt's back.
Yeah,
wow.
Matt's back. No, we're
Clint Reed tonight.
Because we're more in format, we're kind of rotating, going more to like one guest instead of two.
I see. All right.
So, and we'll indulge you with a lot of Air America questions.
Oh,
so,
great. I love
yeah,
that.
I could see your excitement
it's
already spiking.
Great.
Probably play you with the historical focus of the show. We might even get you some Joe Lieberman and George W. Bush clips to respond
oh, that
to
would
and
be
contextualize.
Fantastic. That would be so fantastic.
No, I'm just really. Kidding. You can trash Mark Maron. So, yeah, that's tonight, and looking forward to it.
And Matt. You managed, even while you were on vacation, to drop a new
intro
literary hangover.
Intro to the Scarlet Letter. The full Scarlet Letter we'll be getting into next week, but this is sort of the intro to it, the circumstances under which it was written, and check
That's
it out.
Pretty exciting.
Should
stuff.
Be pretty interesting. I don't know how to sell it more than that.
And, of course, always check out the Antifada on all of your favorite podcast delivery services. All right, we're going to take a quick break. Edit to the Fun app, 646-257-3920.
You are in for it.
All right, folks, 646-257-3920. See you in the Fun app.
Are you ready?
Who sent us this?
Anarchy.
Alpha males are back. Back. And the alpha males are back.
Just as delicious as you can imagine.
The alpha males are back. Boys back. And the alpha males are back.
Just wanna degrade the white man.
Alpha males are back.
I take all of it in my throat.
Alpha males are back.
Almost says what?
The alpha males are back.
You are a madman.
And the alpha males are back.
I am a total cunt.
Can we bring back DJ Danner's song, please?
please.
Yeah, or a couple of them. Just put them in rotation.
DJ Denner.
Well, the problem with those is they're like 45 seconds long, so I don't know if they're enough of a break.
That's fucking nonsense.
Hey, folks, fucking reminder.
I do not have Parkinson's.
And the alpha males are...
Psych. Fuck them.
Almost has what?
What?
Have you tried doing an impression on a college campus?
I think that there's no reason why reasonable people across the divide can't all agree with this. Psych.
The alpha males are back. And the Africans are black. African. And the alpha males are back. And the Africans are black.
Donald Trump out there, doesn't a little part of you think that America deserves to be taken over by jihadists? Keep it at 100. Cannot go hustle.
Come on! Fuck them. Fuck.
Things I do for the bigger game plan.
By the way, it's my birthday!
Happy birthday to me, Jew boy!
I have a thought experiment for you.
And the alpha males are back. Africans are black. Alpha males are back. Africans are black.
Come on!
Someone needs to pay the price for blasphemy around here.
I am a total
pussy.